Okay, so Rebecca then, so we have the four of them, right? Isaac, Rebecca, Esau, Jacob. And now the context of this, and then the four scenes in the text. The context is that Rebecca is living with the knowledge that this promise has been made to her. While she's having this awful pregnancy with these wrestling babies inside, God says, two nations. I'm going to make two nations. She knows as well that God says the younger will take precedence over the older. That would be a big thing to carry as a mother, wouldn't it? Wouldn't you be watching for the younger to take precedence over the older all the time? I'm glad I don't have any of these things in my head as I'm trying to parent two children. It's hard enough as it is. So she knows, and she's likely waiting to see how this will play out. And so when she hears Isaac invite Esau to go out and hunt some game and cook a meal and come back for a blessing, she sees her moment. This is how I can make the blessing come true. So in the first scene, we hear Isaac with his favorite son, Esau. In the second scene, we hear Rebecca with her favorite, Jacob. And she and Jacob work out a plan. Jacob's not totally on board at first, but he is convinced, and he goes along with the plan to impersonate his big brother. In the third scene, Jacob comes to his father, Isaac, but not as himself. He's pretending to be Esau. And of course, Isaac's failing eyesight is really important here. It's an important part of the story. Part of pulling this off depends on Isaac not being able to see that it's actually his younger son. But also there is that moment that wasn't in the reading. We had to skip over some verses, but there's this poignant moment where Isaac actually says, "Are you my son Esau?" And I feel like we all wait for him to go, "Oh no, Dad, I'm so sorry. No, he doesn't tell the truth. That's not what happens. He says, "Yes, yes, I am." Jacob boldly lies. And then when the lie is confirmed by the touch, feeling what feels like Esau's hairy arms, but is actually part of the disguise, Isaac bestows upon Jacob his favor and his legacy. Again, then in the section that we skipped, Esau shows up right after this, almost like they pulled it off right in time. And if it was a movie, you would see Esau coming in from the fields, right? Esau arrives. Isaac realizes what's happened. He blesses Esau, but it is a secondary blessing. He's already given his best to Jacob. Something has happened beyond just Isaac saying something nice to Jacob. He can't duplicate what he's done for Esau. He can't undo somehow what he's given to Jacob. Now, not shockingly, Esau's not super happy about this, right? And can we blame him? Who feels for Esau in this story? I do. I kept thinking, poor Esau. Is this really his fault? So he's not happy. In fact, he's murderously angry. And as any parent can tell you, when you see that your children are about to figuratively do one another in, right? We step in and we go, how about if you go over there? So Rebecca says, "For your own well-being, Jacob, get out of town." And for once, Jacob listens to his parents and both of them and does what they say. And here's the important and interesting part. They send him to Laban, who's going to actually pull one over on Jacob, right? Because now Jacob's going to go to Laban. He's going to fall in love. And he's going to work 7 years. It's this beautiful, weird story. And then when he goes to marry Rachel, he's going to get Leah, and then he's going to have to work 7 more years. Again, if you want to talk about someone to feel sorry for, sign me up for Leah. But anyway, but Laban is going to do one over. Laban, if you think Jacob can make a deal out of anything, wait till he meets Uncle Laban. So they send Jacob to Rebecca's brother, Laban, where this whole drama will unfold as Jacob seeks a wife and gets two. But in the final scene of our reading, these four scenes, Jacob has already fled and is on his way, hasn't gotten to his uncle's yet, and he camps out with a stone for a pillow And he has a pretty crazy dream. An escalator type something or other, with angels ascending and descending. Yahweh shows up in his dream and speaks directly to him. This isn't the story I would have written, right? Well, maybe, but then Yahweh would have been like, dude, get it together. Stop working all the angles. Stop, right? Like, I would have wanted him to have to confess his sin and make it right and do a little learning and maybe a little counseling. And, you know, we'd talk about generational trauma. Like, I know your dad had a rough childhood, which is true. But, like, this isn't how I would have written the story. But Yahweh shows up and blesses the negotiator. Unequivocally blesses him, speaks favor and flourishing, and promises that through Jacob's descendants, I love how to Abraham they were going to be as many as the stars, to Jacob it's dust, right? As much as the dust. But the end result is the same. Every family on earth will be blessed through your family. Oh. And then if that weren't enough, God promises divine presence and divine protection. It's quite a story, really. And we're left, I think, or I'm left scratching my head a little. Is Jacob the hero? Am I meant to emulate Jacob the negotiator? Is Rebecca brilliant and faithful at seizing the moment, or devious and conniving? I'm honestly not sure what the answer to that question is. Is Esau rightly pushed aside? And after all, he angrily and bitterly defies his parents, marrying a Canaanite, once he realizes how much it'll irk them. That's another part of the text we skipped over. Is there anyone in the story who's blameless? That I know the answer to. No. There is no one in the story that you go, this is the person we're all meant to. There's a reason I didn't tell the story to the children this morning. Because it's a little tricky with kids to go, there's the four humans that are all kind of messed up. Although actually maybe that's the story they need to know. Here's some humans, they're messed up. God shows up in the middle of it. Oh, actually maybe that's what we need to know. So Rebecca has acted to make something happen that she heard God promise. So is her action faithfulness or forcing something? Jacob has shown himself to be able to take advantage of situations as they arise. Both things that fall in his lap, like Esau being willing to give up his birthright, and situations where more effort is involved, like impersonating Esau in order to receive Isaac's blessing. But what about God? Where is God in this story? In the context, God has told Rebecca, while she's still pregnant, that the younger will be the recipient of the divine blessing, continuing on the fulfillment of the covenant made with Abraham. In the story itself, God appears in Jacob's dream and speaks blessing. So God, in this story, promises and makes good on the promise. So then the only thing remaining is, what about us? Is there anything in this story that speaks to our own situation? What happens when we know that God has promised blessing, but the blessing hasn't come yet? What are our options when we're living in the in-between places? How do we find those places that require some action? Because it's not just passively waiting for a blessing to fall down, right? We are invited to be part of things. But how do we also avoid forcing a blessing? How do we discover that God is in places we didn't expect? I love that line towards the end of the text when Jacob wakes from this epic dream and it says he thought to himself, the Lord is definitely in this place, but I didn't know it. Jacob, the blessed one, is on the run. His life has unraveled, and he's about to enter another challenging season. He's going to work 7 years for a woman he loves and then be duped by Laban and have to work another 7 to get the right woman. And he'll have that unthinkable challenge of being married to 2 sisters. Any of you want to try that? It sounds hard. But much like Bethel, Jacob will discover that God is present, even in places where Jacob doesn't expect. So what if Paula Darcy is right when she writes, God comes to you disguised as your life? If your life this morning looks a bit like Rebecca's, you're waiting for the fulfillment of promises you've known a long time, God comes to you there. If your life looks more like Isaac's, you're facing your own end. Death doesn't look quite so far off on the horizon anymore. You're grappling with the realities of aging, of diminishing abilities, of diminishing strength. God comes to you there. If your life looks like Esau's, volatile, filled with regrets, broken relationships, ill-conceived decisions, God comes to you there. If your life looks like Jacob's, struggling, striving, negotiating, running, God comes to you there. No matter what your life looks like today, what if, just for a moment, you were to consider the possibility that God is coming to you today, disguised as your own life? What if God is definitely in this place you're in right now, even if you didn't realize it? What do we do when we live in that tension between promise and blessing? How do we inhabit this in-between place? Where we know, yes, that God is ultimately making all things new, but we also know that it's taking part slowly, so painfully slowly sometimes. How do we inhabit this place? I think we inhabit it a few ways. One, we stay curious. We keep wondering, asking, watching to discover God coming to us in our everyday, run-of-the-mill lives. Secondly, we realize that everybody else is doing the same thing. Do you want to know what happens when I talk to you guys one-on-one? But I'm not going to tell anybody's secret. So just relax. If you've had a one-on-one conversation, I'm not going to tell your story. Except, do you know what everybody tells me? They tell me how they're not like everybody else in the church. How everyone else is a little more connected. Everyone else is a little more okay. You all tell me that. Some of you more openly than others. But part of how we live in this in-between space is to realize that everybody is living in this in-between place, even when it looks like they've already got the blessing they were waiting for. And yes, there are those moments and we rejoice when they come, but there's always more to our stories. So I think we stay curious. I think we do it together and realize that we're all in the same boat in that sense. And so this morning, I invite you to take a moment to listen for God's voice, inviting you to see, to notice that God is indeed coming to you, present with you, right as your life currently is, not when you get it together a little more, or after this happens, or once that happens, or once this is settled, now, in whatever tensions you're experiencing. So let's just take a moment, and then we'll pray together. God, we confess that sometimes our blessings and dreams confound and confuse us, like Jacob. At times we are uncertain what it is you want us to do next. Help us on that journey. When our steps falter, be with us. When the future is uncertain, comfort us. When the world is overwhelming, help us to rest. When we realize again that we are imperfect, equip us. Remind us that you are our God no matter what. That you come to us sometimes even in the disguise of our everyday lives. Help us along the way, we pray. Amen. I'll invite the team to come and we'll sing together. Would you stand? So, wherever you are, may you discover God coming, sometimes even in the disguise of your own life. May you discover that God is still looking to bless and keep you. That God is still all about making his face shine upon you and being gracious to you. That God is still all about lifting up his countenance upon you, looking you in the face, right in the eyes. And God is still giving peace. May we all discover that a little more this week. Go in peace.